Good morning and welcome to the KUNM Call-In Show. I'm your host, Gwyneth Doland. This morning, we are going to look into our crystal balls and talk about what the future holds for our state. What can we be? What will we be? What will we be? Those are two questions that open New Mexico 2050, a new book of essays collected by Fred Harris that describe where we are now in terms of the economy, the environment, education, and other vital issues. Where could we be in 35 years? And perhaps most importantly, what do we have to do to get there? Today, we're going to hear from some of the contributors in the book, and we want to hear from you, too. We'll take your calls in just a few minutes, or you can post comments to our Facebook page, KUNM Radio. These essays were selected and edited by former U.S. Senator Fred Harris, a professor emeritus of political science here at UNM. He's written about 20 books on the subject of politics, policy, and government, and he is with us here in the studio today. Thank you for being with us, Senator.
You bet. Thanks for having us.
You describe this book as a hymn book for proud New Mexicans who want the land of enchantment to become the land of opportunity for all. I like your religious analogy there. Do you see this book as a kind of come to Jesus, kick in the pants for New Mexico politicians?
Well, maybe that. I want it really to be a blueprint for New Mexico's future. And I've been really impressed that so many people who are interested in policymaking and in politics and government have really taken this book to heart, and it's been doing very well in circulation.
Now, you served as a Democrat elected to Congress from Oklahoma in the late 60s and early 70s, and you have stayed involved in Democratic politics for a long time. Does this book try to speak to Republicans, or is it targeted specifically to Democrats who might implement this stuff?
No, it's for everybody. It's really for teachers. It's for professors and students. It's for policymakers. It's for everybody who's really interested in what's happening in New Mexico and how we can make New Mexico better.
Well, in this first part of the hour, we have one of your contributors with us here in the studio. Aaron Sussman works with the Mid-Region Council of Governments, which we normally call Mr. Cog. And Aaron, you wrote the chapter on transportation and planning. Welcome to the show, Aaron.
Thank you for having me.
I noticed that you rode your bicycle to the studio today. And I want to talk to you. I'll let our listeners know that you are young. You are a millennial, am I right?
Yeah.
Okay. And that means people who are, I think, up to about 30 now?
Sure. About 1980 is the kind of cutoff for millennials.
So, you know, the way that younger people have grown up has shaped their views on how they get around. And, you know, for example, a lot of teenagers today are delaying getting their driver's licenses for many reasons. They're harder to get. Cars are more expensive. They drive less than we do. So with these folks in mind, these folks who will be the architects of whatever change we're talking about, what do you see as the biggest problems confronting us now in terms of the way we get around the state to school, to work, from rural areas to urban areas? What are the biggest problems we have?
Sure. So one of the kind of fundamental themes that I write about in the essay, and I think one of the really interesting policy questions right now is the fact that people really are traveling and behaving differently than they did in the past. And you speak about millennials, to some degree that behavior is shared across generations, but that's a really fundamental part of this, is that people are behaving differently. And going along with that is the fact that New Mexico is, I think, going to go through some growing pains in the sense that this is a state that in a lot of respects has defined itself or identified itself as a rural state, but it's very much an urbanizing state. Right now, about half of the state lives in the four metro areas in Santa Fe, Albuquerque, Las Cruces, and Farmington. That's going to go up to about three quarters in the coming decades. There are a lot of rural parts of the state that are losing population. Full two-thirds of the counties in New Mexico lost population in the 2000s. That was a time when the state was growing, at a time when the state is not growing overall. There's even more growth in cities relative to rural areas. So that's going to be a real challenge and something that really needs to be confronted in New Mexico, especially when we talk about kind of how we identify ourselves.
So I hear you saying we need to find a way to absorb more people into Albuquerque and the other metro areas and get them around. I mean, this is a problem we know we already have with traffic in cities. How are we supposed to change the way we move around in cities in order to accommodate so many more people?
Sure. So I think, so first of all, to your first point, whether we like it or not, whether we want it to happen or not, that's a reality, is that the cities will grow over time. And so how do we get around? That's a great question. So there's two kind of competing and in some ways contradictory trends going on. The first is that people are driving less than they used to. The average person drives about 10% fewer miles per day than they did 10 years ago. That's a trend that started before the recession, so it's not purely economic based. And the other thing that we see is that people are looking for more transportation options. So in the sense of, if you have more people in the same amount of space, that can create more congestion. But because behavior is changing, congestion doesn't necessarily have to be an absolutely disastrous state of affairs. And it doesn't necessarily have to be our future that we become a city that we think of like Los Angeles or a major city where there's just gridlock everywhere all the time. The biggest thing, I think, in terms of accommodating additional residents, but also meeting the needs of younger residents, and you spoke earlier about the sort of changing relationship to driving, and millennials in particular, is creating more and more transportation options. So one of the things that we can discern from looking at surveys and behavioral preference studies over time is that younger generations in particular walk more, take public transit to a greater degree, they bike more, they're looking for more transportation options. So a question will be, how much does that change and evolve as sort of life cycles change, as millennials become parents? And certainly there will be some modification of behavior, but from everything that we're seeing is that younger generations really do behave differently. Millennials today drive less than millennials, or people who were of millennials' age today than people of a similar age did 10 to 15 years ago. Again, behavior is just simply shifting.
But you bring up a great point that did not even occur to me. People are delaying having kids, so it's fun to walk around when you're not lugging a bunch of kids with you. But these folks might change their minds as soon as they've got car seats.
Sure. That's the assumption, is that that behavior will meet the profile of older generations. But it's not clear that that's going to be entirely the case. That's likely to fall somewhere in between behavior of millennials today and the behavior of Gen Xers and older generation.
So if we need to provide more transportation options, does that mean necessarily more mass transportation, more public transportation, like these rapid bus lines that we're talking about now?
Yeah, absolutely. Because what you're talking about is an ability to move more people in the same amount of space, an ability to provide reliable transportation options, but also an ability to provide transportation options that meet demands and needs of an evolving set of market preferences. And because more and more people not just are moving to urban areas, but there's a greater preference for easy access to services and amenities and ability to walk to a grocery store or a restaurant, that's shared across generations. It's just most prominent among millennials. And one of the things that's really fundamental when you talk about transportation is first talk about housing. So we have an enormous supply of single family housing in kind of suburban settings. We don't have an enormous supply of more compact housing options in more urban environments. And so one of the things that we look at the Mid-Region Council of Governments, one of the things that I talk about is not, you know, necessarily we have to move away from a suburban style of living, but we need to have a greater range of options so that we can accommodate that range of preferences. And particularly among younger generations, we talk a lot too about the relationship between New Mexico's economy, the type of investments we should make in housing and transportation. There's clearly a connection between the cities that are doing well across the country and the type of lifestyle options that they provide, the ability to walk and bike and take transit for a number of trips, not necessarily all trips, but at least some, a range of housing options. The growth that's projected in the number of zero-child households and single-person households is enormous. And if you think about the existing housing stock, where you've got a lot of large, several thousand square foot houses and sort of more suburban settings, that may not necessarily make sense for a growing set of lifestyle preferences. So all of these things are kind of wrapped up together.
Senator Harris, you were a young man in the golden age of the automobile.
Right.
When we as a country began to worship our cars and their beautiful fins and their glorious headlights. But now, you know, things have changed. How do you think we can persuade people like you and even me who grew up cherishing the freedom of the open road and our cars? How do we make policy decisions that persuade people they need to get out of their cars and walk a little more in for the health of the community?
I think really more and more of them want to do that. We've got to give them the possibilities of doing it. We need to put more money into not just highways and roads, but also into mass transit and public transportation generally. I think the demand is there, and the demand is certainly going to grow, just as Aaron has said, and that's where we need to be making additional investments.
But it is a political problem, because we see this, you know, nationally, this resistance to subsidizing Amtrak when all these other countries in the world have these, you know, vibrant, robust train systems that go everywhere, and they pay a lot for them, right? You know, we pay for these roads, we subsidize roads, but so far we haven't had the political will to subsidize in the same way trains like the Rail Runner. Richardson made it happen, but there is lingering resentment and regular threats to cut the funding for this, because why are we throwing all this money at this train? How do you resolve that dynamic, the resistance to pay for other things than roads?
Well, I think one thing is programs like this, we need to get out the facts. We, as you've just said, we subsidize transportation now, but it's primarily in the highways, roads and highways, and there's, we should think the same thing about mass transit or about the Rail Runner, for example. And incidentally, local counties have also voted taxes on themselves to help pay for that. But that that is a need that is for public transportation like the Rail Runner and more of it, and it's something we ought to do. We ought not to expect it to make a profit. We don't expect the highways to make a profit. We expect that to be done because we need it and the demand for it's going to grow.
Callers, we want to hear what you think about how you get around your community today. Should we be focusing on fixing the roads that are covered with potholes and making bigger roads, more bridges, more lanes? Or should we be structuring our cities in terms of planning the housing and planning public transportation to make it easier to get around that way? Call us now at 277-5866 here in Albuquerque. That's 277-5866 or toll free 877-899-5866. You can send your comments or questions in an email to callinshow@kunm.org. We'll be right back.
Support comes from the 7th Annual Santa Fe Independent Film Festival, October 14th through the 18th. Over 100 films, panels, discussions, and parties in downtown Santa Fe. Details and tickets at santafeindependent.com.
Historical images of drama, celebration, and tragedy from the Mexican Revolution are at the Maxwell Museum of Anthropology at UNM. Opening celebration, Friday, September 18th, 6 to 8 p.m. Maxwell Museum proudly supports KUNM.
Hey, Shannon.
What?
It's that time again. Tune in to YMP's Audio Revolution. We will be exploring the topic of coming out, and we'll have all kinds of stories from strong people who decide that they have no choice but to be who they are.
Check out the personal stories about relatives who have come out, interviews with local activists, research of resources and support services for those who are in need, and much more. Listen to Youth Media Project's Audio Revolution this Friday at 8 a.m. on KUNM 89.9 FM.
Welcome back to the KUNM Call-In Show. My guest today, Senator Fred Harris, the author of New Mexico 2050, a book of policy prescriptions for issues facing New Mexico now, including transportation. And we have Aaron Sussman from Mr. Cog, the Mid-Region Council of Governments, with us. Aaron, we're going to let you go in just a minute, but before you do, let's hear from Clifton in Albuquerque, who wants to talk about subsidizing roads. Welcome to the show, Clifton.
Good morning. You know, you just brought up the comparison of subsidizing roads and subsidizing mass transit. I think it's important also to bring up how much subsidies reduce the cost of the gasoline that we use to drive, and that if we shifted those subsidies away from the petroleum industry, there'd be a great deal of money to help support public transportation. And not only that, people's cost as individuals to drive would rise, which would also help a behavioral shift. And I'd like to remind your listeners that Los Angeles saw a significant amount of political will almost eradicate public transportation when General Motors and Firestone got together and made it difficult for their public transportation back in the early part of the last century. See what your panel has to say about that.
Thank you so much, Clifton. I'll tell you what I say about that. If Clifton were a political candidate and he said, here's what I'm going to do, I'm going to raise the price of your gas, he would not be elected. Aaron, is that something that's possible to say, let's make the gas more expensive to push people into doing this?
Well, I think Clifton is absolutely right in the sense of subsidizing single occupancy vehicle driving because we don't fully charge motorists the true cost of driving. And the biggest issue from a public policy perspective is that the gas tax hasn't been raised in two decades at a state level or a federal level. It's not tied to inflation. So revenue generation is lower and lower effectively every year. Simply what you can purchase with the revenue that we're generating is diminished every year. And not only that, but we're moving in a direction where vehicles are becoming more efficient. And as fuel efficiency standards improve, or if we do switch over to a largely electric vehicle fleet into the future, we're talking about diminished revenue generation or zero revenue generation from the gas tax. So that's a really increasingly ill-suited mechanism for funding transportation. It doesn't impose the true costs of driving on motorists. It means that money needs to come from other sources.
So where should we be getting the money for transportation, if not from the gas tax?
Well, so this is one of the more ambitious ideas that Senator Harris asked us to consider. And so one of the things that I propose in the book is something called the vehicle miles traveled tax. And this is an idea that's being explored in a few states, in Oregon, Washington, California. Oregon is the farthest along with this idea. The idea is that rather than raise revenue for transportation through gasoline taxes, it's through the number of miles that you travel. And it's basically much more of a pay-as-you-go system. Regardless of what type of car that you drive, you are contributing to the system. So that is a more effective way of maintaining roads. What the state of Oregon found in their most recent pilot program is that by linking revenue generation to vehicle miles traveled, the distances that people traveled actually went down and revenue generation went up. So it's effective both at managing congestion and at generating the revenue that's much needed for maintaining the transportation system that we have. One of the benefits of those kind of systems, too, is that if there is excess revenue, you can use that to invest in alternative forms of transportation so that people don't feel the desire to drive, that there are other meaningful options out there.
Aaron, thank you so much for being with us this morning. We are going to find a link to that program in Oregon, and we will post that on our website so people can look more at that later. Thank you again for coming in.
Again, thank you for having me.
Now we have with us in the studio Veronica Tiller, who is an expert on the economics of Indian country. Listeners, we would love to hear from you, so call in now with your questions for Veronica Tiller. It's 277-5866 or toll-free 877-899-5866. So, Dr. Tiller, we want to hear from you what you think the... You write that some of the most important issues for us now are climate change and energy. How do those two things disproportionately impact folks who are living in Indian country?
Indian country here is New Mexico. In New Mexico is large. There are 19 pueblos and 3 Apache tribes in the Navajo, and they occupy territory of almost 5 million acres here in New Mexico. And their revenue, in large part, comes from energy resources, the Navajo tribe, as well as the Hickory Apache tribe. And so they are impacted because of the amount of land that they have, the water resources that they have, the amount of timber resources located on the reservations.
And things, I'm thinking of things like the coal-fired power plants in the Four Corners area that have both economic and health impacts on folks living in Indian Country.
Absolutely. That has been a very important issue in the last perhaps decade with the coal-fired plants, some of them that are going to be shut down, and the regulations that say they have to have put out cleaner coal. And that has impacted the Navajo tribe very, very much, because a lot of those are located in northwestern New Mexico, and a lot of jobs are tied to that industry.
So you predict in your chapter in this book, New Mexico 2050, that Native Americans will become more active partners in solving the problems that face New Mexico now, that they will move more and more into cities like Aaron Sussman just told us folks from all over the state will be doing, but that they will also retain their cherished culture, heritage, and uniqueness. I think that we will see this same challenge for folks who are moving to urban areas from rural areas all over the state. But how do you see that the role and the power of our Native American communities will change in the next 35 years?
Well, I think there are several things. For one thing, about the Indian tribes is that their ties to their land has been since ancient times, since time immemorial. The lands to them are sacred. And while there is going to be movement into the urban areas because of jobs, the same patterns that affect the rest of the New Mexicans also affects the Indian tribes in terms of the need for jobs, educational institutions, places to the marketplace, the places to shop. All of those affect the Indian tribes, but their ties to their lands is very important. And so while other people can move away when things are not optimal for them or there are other opportunities, for Indian tribes, for the Indian people, these are our lands. We're going to stay here no matter what.
Right. So I hear you saying, whereas other people who might be frustrated with pollution from power plants, or other people who might want to move around to take advantage of jobs in another part of the state, folks in Indian Country are less able to do that because of their ties to the land. Senator Harris, you know, we're talking right now about looking 35 years into the future, as the title of your book says, New Mexico 2050. Now, you were a senator from Oklahoma about 40 years ago.
Right.
And Oklahoma has a lot of the same issues we do here, and also has a prominent and big Native American constituency. Looking back instead of forward for a moment, how many of the issues facing Indian Country now are the same as they were when you were trying to fix those problems in Congress?
Well, they're better in a number of ways. First, I think more and more people understand that Indian tribes are units of government in our federal system, and we've more and more begun to recognize that we ought to have government-to-government relations, and that people have a right to all of the privileges of citizenship, whether they're Indians or not, plus their entitlements as a result of Indian treaties and their mention in the Constitution. The casinos have been a big boost for the tribes that have them available, and they've I think increased education education opportunities for Indian kids and jobs on the reservation. So things are somewhat better than they were, but I think that a great deal more needs to be done for economic development and for the strengthening of tribal governments.
Dr. Tiller, Senator Harris mentioned the casinos as a big driver of change in Indian Country here, especially in New Mexico. Is there another casinos out there? Is there another big thing that you think will drive jobs and economic activity for Indian Country?
I think the issues surrounding climate change will bring in new technology. And I think with the help of the continuing help of the federal government as well as the state of New Mexico, I think the Indian tribes can have an impact on the energy because the technology is available, the will is there. Indian tribes have already made big strides in environmental protection. They have done things like restore their ecosystems. They have run pretty prudent forest management programs, and they have done things like take greater interest in the protection of their environment. Like, for example, Isla de Pueblo in 1992 had better and stricter standards for clean water.
And, you know, we just saw this out with the Gold King mine spill. We saw the Navajo Nation really being aggressive about protecting their water and demanding more testing and more accountability from the EPA. We have a call now from Aaron in Albuquerque. Aaron, welcome to the show.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So what do you want to talk about today?
Well, I heard the comment about kind of the trends of Natives being encouraged to move to the cities and how they're affected by kind of like the larger trends that affect all of us. And it just made me think of the situation, kind of like the ongoing situation with the police and how Native people in particular, poor and homeless Native people in particular, are targeted constantly by the police. And so I'm trying to, like, I guess, encourage listeners to think about just like what direction we want that to go in. We're actually hosting, this city, Albuquerque, is hosting the National Police Shooting Championship starting this Saturday. And in a city in which shooting violence has been a huge problem, that just seems ludicrous to me.
Aaron, is there something that you think we can do to change the relationship between police and Native Americans?
Definitely. I think, I think it starts with coming together and organizing. We're actually having a march on Saturday, 6 p.m., Robinson Park. We're stepping off, marching to the embassy streets where it's being held. But I think basically organizing, coming together, realizing that these individuals who are being targeted are not alone, that the power is when we come together and stand up and resist, take back our streets. This is all Native land. Native people need to come together and, unite with all of their accomplices of all colors and races and all that.
Aaron, thank you for bringing up that important topic. We appreciate it. Dr. Tiller, in this book, we are, Senator Harris has asked for policy prescriptions to move New Mexico forward into the next generation. What do you think we need to do to improve now the economic situation for Indian country all over the state? What are the most important things that we can do now?
One of the things that I addressed in my chapter in the book is that I think there is a greater need for a better relationship between the state of New Mexico and the Indian tribes. For example, I just read that Governor Martinez had just issued a comprehensive energy plan for the state of New Mexico. While I have not examined that report in any depth, I also beginning to think, to what extent did she involve the Indian tribes? Because New Mexico cannot go on thinking that the Indian tribes are the responsibility of the federal government and that they can exist out there without some involvement in the welfare of the state of New Mexico. So I think that's a number one concern or consideration. That
bring them to the table.
Right, bring them to the table, absolutely, in almost every area, because tribes are, they have their own governments. They are quasi-sovereign governments, and they have their own laws, their own regulations, and I think that we have to partner with the state of New Mexico in making sure that we are all on the same page, because when you come to an issue like climate change, there is no state, there is no tribe, there's only all of us.
Now, you say that Governor Martinez and government needs to reach out and make sure that they talk to and incorporate Native communities when they're doing things like coming up with an energy plan.
Absolutely.
Are there things that you want to see from the Pueblo and tribal governments. Do you think that they need to make some changes in order to make this happen?
Yes, I think so. One of the things I'm thinking for the tribes or the Indian communities is that I think that they ought to take the climate change more seriously because we have more at stake. And I think that they're already doing things like the restoration and the preservation of their ecosystems, the protection of their water and forests and so forth. But I think that they ought to also consider that, you know, there are measures that they can take within their own communities with regard to energy efficiency for their buildings, even their office, even their tribal vehicle, their fleets. You know, there are things like that that they can begin to do to start thinking about coming up with strategies for dealing with energy efficiencies and preservation and so forth, so that the tribal governments have the authorities within their jurisdiction to do these sorts of things without having to go either to the state or to the federal government.
Listeners, we want to hear what you think about these issues today. What do you think the state of New Mexico and the federal government need to do to better communicate with Indian country and to improve outcomes for folks who are living in Indian country? And what do you think tribal and Pueblo governments need to do to secure a better future for the folks in their communities? Let us know. Call us now at 277-5866 or toll free 877-899-5866. You can tweet at KUNM News, or you can find us on Facebook. Senator Harris, I want to come back to you here. You know, what do you think the successes have been over the past 40 years in improving outcomes for those in Native communities outside of casinos? Because, you know, there are pluses and minuses with the casinos. We've seen a lot of economic development, but we've also seen in the news quite recently a reminder that gambling addiction is a persistent problem that is related to that development. So what other successes have you seen in Indian country over the past, say, 40 years, 35 years?
Well, they've really gotten, for example, the energy resource tribes have organized, and that's been very important. And they're developing their own resources in a proper way and for their for the benefit of their own tribal members. That's a big change. When I moved to New Mexico 40 years ago, I talked to a guy who said, "I don't know what's the matter with this tribe here," as local Pueblo. He said, "We used to be able," this was a county commissioner, he said, "We used to be go over there and get the gravel whenever we needed it." And he said, "Now they've fenced off their gravel pit and we can't get gravel at will." Well, it's required some change on the part of non-Indians in their attitudes, that Indian tribes have rights. They control and own their own resources. And I think they've been doing a much better job of that themselves, at developing their own resources.
Dr. Teller, we have a Twitter comment from Jim here saying politics is the biggest barrier to New Mexico achieving a sustainable future. Just briefly, do you agree that that is just the process of politics and the arguing is a problem for advancing Indian country?
Absolutely. There's no doubt about that.
We also have a call from Wade in Santa Fe. Wade, welcome to the show.
I've been doing a lot of driving recently to Texas and Oklahoma, and what I'm noticing are windmill farms everywhere. Here we are in New Mexico. There's a lot of open space. There's abundant wind. There's abundant sunshine. It would seem to me that the way they bring state government and federal government to the table of the Native Americans is for them to become generators of energy. I'm wondering if there's, I see so much of this, as I say, when I'm driving through Texas and Oklahoma. Are there any plans on the table for any of the tribes to start building windmill farms and generating alternative energy that could then be sold and we can all become customers.
Wade, thank you for that. Dr. Tiller, we just have about a minute left here. What do you know about the process of bringing wind energy development to Indian Country in New Mexico? Is that happening?
Yes, it's happening. I know the Pueblo of Jemez has started looking into that. How far it has gone, I don't know. But I also know that when tribes start doing these kinds of projects, like the solar farms, I know that sometimes the Public Service of New Mexico, you know, doesn't allow them to go further because they're the ones that have the grid. They're in charge of the grid. And so in order for Indian tribes to get on the grid, they have to have something like PNM to sell their electricity to, and so there needs to be better cooperation. And I think the state needs to invoke some kind of regulations that say that PNM has got to deal in part with the energy produced by the Indian tribes to go onto that grid.
Thank you so much for being with us today, Dr. Tiller. We've been talking about what New Mexico will be like 35 years from now, and next we will be bringing on Dr. Veronica Garcia. And in a few minutes, we'll hear from poet Hakeem Bellamy. We'll hear him read the poem he wrote for this book. What do you want to see in the year 2050? And what do we have to change in order to make that happen? Call in now. The number is 277-5866. Here in Albuquerque, 277-5866. Or toll free, 877-899-5866. Or tweet at KUM News. We'll be right back.
If your KUNM membership lapses by December, you'll get a letter asking you to renew before October 16th, while you have three chances to win beautiful folk art prizes donated by the International Folk Art Market Santa Fe. You can also donate at KUNM.org. We really need as much help as you can give since we had to replace some major equipment this year. Please be as generous as you can. If you can't give, to enter, send an email to prizes@KUNM.org.
Each week, New Dimensions explores the social, political, scientific, environmental, and spiritual frontiers with some of today's foremost social innovators, thinkers, scientists, and creative artists.
Hi, I'm Ethan Nickturn, author of The Road Home. Next time on New Dimensions, I'll be talking about a contemporary exploration of Buddhism.
Saturday mornings at 6 on KUNM.
Welcome back to the KUNM Call-In Show. I'm Gwyneth Dolan, and I am here in the studio with Fred Harris, the author of New Mexico 2050, a book that describes the problems that New Mexico faces now and offers suggestions for how to solve them. One of his co-authors in this book is Dr. Veronica Garcia. She's the executive director of Voices for Children, a nonprofit that advocates for children's welfare. She's also a former teacher, principal, superintendent, and state secretary of education. Welcome to the show.
Good morning, Gwyneth.
Dr. Garcia, I'd like to start by asking you to look into your book in the chapter there and read us the first paragraph that you wrote.
Well,
I was struck by it because it's very emphatic, and I wanted to hear it in your voice.
New Mexico is in crisis. New Mexico is in crisis. New Mexico is in crisis. Shout it from the rooftops. Printed in two-inch, bold-face headlines above the fold in the newspapers, sound the alarm on radio and television, similar to amber and weather alerts, plaster it on billboards, make it the focus of sermon and speeches, list it as a standing item on all agendas, and include it as a major plank of all political campaigns. Am I exaggerating? No. New Mexico is in crisis.
All right, now we hear you. I hear you. You've got my attention. You say that our crisis in education in particular involves more than just the education system. It's poverty, income inequality, health, the status of family and the community, and race. That's a pretty complicated ball of problems right there. Are there some simple things that you think we should do to tackle this problem and make a difference in education through tackling these other problems?
Thank you, Gwyneth. And just a little bit of a background. At that time when this chapter was written, New Mexico was 50th in child well-being. And I have always felt that education and children cannot be looked at in an isolated context, that children live in communities, in families, and that if we're going to properly educate children, we have to look at them holistically. There are two major issues that I think we can turn this trajectory around for New Mexico. The first is poverty. And poverty has some short-term, I would say, band-aids that we can attach to make life a little bit easier and to support our children. And those are income supports, like earned income tax credit, SNAP, you know, food stamps so that children, what we used to call food stamps, so that children don't go to school hungry, raising the minimum wage that would make a significant difference in the lives of children, child care assistance so that parents can work and have their children taken care of. But if we really want to turn poverty around in New Mexico, the key for me, and I talk about my own personal experience in my life, and I also talk about not making policy by exception, but we do know that education is the key to moving out of poverty and to a better quality of life. And the research tells us that while there is no one silver bullet, and not only research, but economists like James Heckman, Nobel Prize laureate, a winner, economist, is that the best return on investment and the best way to turn this around is to invest in the early years, home visitation, quality childcare, and pre-K. If we were to invest in those three things, most likely children will be reading by third grade, will graduate from high school ready for college or career, and be able to be contributing members of our society.
Senator Harris, you know, this is an observer of the state legislature, and so I've seen some of these battles play out, and I know that you've been watching this and participating in your long political career. There is a common argument here between people who say we just need to invest. We need to spend more money. We need to spend more money on early childhood, maybe take it from the permanent fund. We need to put more money into supports and things like that. And then there are those who say, I'm not throwing any more money at it. Does it have to take an investment of tax dollars in order to improve this? Or do you think there are other ways that we can improve education outcomes?
Well, you know, what a lot of people want to do is give advice to the poor. But poor people, you know, and there's some who want to punish them for being poor. I used to be poor. And I can say that being poor is punishment enough. And what poor people need is not advice. What they need is money. And the best way to get money is with a job. And the best way to build jobs in New Mexico is to invest. My old cowboy dad, he used to say, you can't make money without spending some money. And that's really true. We're talking about not expenditures. We're talking about investment, and invest in ourselves. That's what we need to do, and the best way to do that is in education.
We have a comment from Twitter here from Eli, and he says, it is appalling that we care more about third world countries halfway around the world than we do about the third world nations inside our border. Thank you for that, Eli. On the phone right now, we have Travis in Albuquerque. Welcome to the show, Travis. Do we have you, Travis?
Here.
Hiya.
Hi. I just wanted to contribute. I think we need to kind of rekindle our connection to the sacredness of food and land and water. And if we're talking about where we want to be in 2050, how about a garden in every school, a community garden in every city park, community gardens at affordable housing units, things like that, where we have edible landscapes across our whole city and people can eat food free of money, just have food growing and in their homes and their communities and their parks and their schools. I think that would really help out. And also jobs that could support it, garden education positions and things like that that could contribute jobs. And it also ties into the education and the early childhood stuff that you guys are talking about as well.
Well, that sounds like a delicious idea, Travis. Thank you for contributing it. Also on the phone right now, we have Jan in Mountain Air. Welcome to the show, Jan.
Hi, Gwyneth. So one of the things that I've observed in this small town in Mountain Air, and I suspect it's probably true in most rural school districts, is there is no requirement for any kind of qualification to be a school board member. And I know in some ways that probably sounds fairly elitist, and yet the reality is in this school district, there are, it's a five-member school board. Only one of those members has ever been to college, and that was for one semester. So we have a school board here that does not have a vision, that does not truly see the value of education. And I'm not saying that every student is college material. I certainly don't think that. But what I'm seeing here is a school board that that's not prepared to really push what's needed in the system to prepare these kids for their future, no matter what it might be.
Jan, thank you so much for bringing up the issue of raising those qualifications. Dr. Garcia, you know, we're talking about what we need to see from the very top levels of government, coming down from the governor and the secretary of education through policy made in the legislature. But what about coming from the ground up? Do you think we need to do things like raising qualifications for school board members at the very local level in small communities? Is that something that could have an impact?
You know, I understand where she may be coming from, but I don't know that it's very democratic. And I don't think that we have those kinds of qualifications. I think recently we may have done something with the PRC. But I have known some amazing board members that were very committed, that weren't necessarily college educated, that really learned in the role. There is a wonderful association, the New Mexico School Boards Association, that provides great training. I think all board members should afford themselves of all the professional development that they can get. But they're elected by their communities. And if their communities are not engaged, I think that's where the responsibility is voting in these elections. Voter turnout is so poor. And it really is appalling at how much we don't value our right or responsibility to be able to vote. And I hope that this will serve as a wake-up call if there is discord in communities to get out and vote. And also, you know, if this woman feels as strongly, maybe she ought to run for office.
Great, great idea. I think, Jan, we want to see some signs around Mountain Air announcing her name for the school board. In a moment, we're going to hear from Albuquerque's first poet laureate, Hakeem Bellamy, who's going to read the poem that he wrote for this book. But before we shift there, Dr. Garcia, I know that your organization, Voices for Children, has been pushing for a number of years now to change the way we fund early childhood education and take a little bit of money from the permanent fund, which we also sometimes call the rainy day fund. But if we cannot make that happen, and so far the political will has not been there to do that, is there one other policy change that you think we could do to make a dramatic difference in outcomes for children? Is there any one other thing that you think you could get behind if we can't change the funding mechanism?
Well, I don't think there's any one other thing that I can think of that's more important than the early years. I mean, it is so fundamental because of the brain science and what we know behind that. I would say let's finish the rollout on pre-K. We're fairly close. There was a commitment to finish that in 5 years. We compromised to seven. The recession hit. Let's get that done so that there aren't waiting lists, so that children can, be better prepared. But it's hard for me to get away from that because I think it was so a key.
Senator Harris, when UNM Press came to you and asked you to do this book, they said, hey, go find some great people, and you did, to write these chapters, and some of them have very dense information that's super valuable about transportation planning. We talked earlier with Aaron Sussman, and so there's a lot of facts and figures in some of these chapters, but you also chose a poet to be a part of it. Why did you do that?
Well, I think that, there's poetry in New Mexico. This is a poetic place, and I think there's reality in poetry. It comes from the heart, and nobody does it better than Hakeem Bellamy.
Fantastic. Hakeem Bellamy, welcome to the show.
Hi, Gwyneth. Good morning.
So I read your poem. I mean, it's in the front of the book, so it was the first thing I actually really read. There's a wide range of emotion in here. It's a little bit bitter, but it's also affectionate, and it's hopeful. At the end, you pose a question. When you were writing this poem, what did you want your audience to feel?
All the things I felt. You know, I was lucky, thanks to Senator Harris, to be one of the first readers of the book because he was able to get me the chapters that were finished and as they came in, because we really wanted to endeavor to do something that was a response to the reading. There's no way in a poem that I could reach the depth of what these experts reached, but it was an honor, really, to be asked to be part of this kind of collective strategizing, this bringing art to this kind of collective thinking about what we want our future to be. And I feel like as an artist and as a poet, that's just my job. My job is to bring people together around community issues.
Well, let's hear it.
New Mexico 2050, ? A prefatory poem. New Mexico has been called lots of things by the upper 48. My favorite is recession-proof, like some sort of backhanded condiment, like vinegar when I ordered chile, like drought instead of desert, like climate change for dinner instead of rain for breakfast. But mean is not what they mean. When poor is the new normal, you can't feel the economy flatline, just like you couldn't feel it when it was booming, just like the bottom of the ocean, unmoved by the waves. What they meant is irrelevant. Even insignificant, because we take everything as a compliment. Because at 2050, with the oldest state capital in the country, we look damn good for our age. Compared to their Dow Jones average, we are finally exceptional, breaking the curve one border at a time. 36 years from here, New Mexico will still be exotic to others and enchanting to us. We'll still be inventing new names to call ourselves, still be creating new races every monsoon season of love. New Mexico will still be magic, like a horizon-taut canvas making something out of nothing, pulling a rabbit out of the mesa, waiting a sign, with both ears to the sky. Nothing under its sleeve but Sacred Heart ink, a sequía sangre underneath its adobe-flavored skin, hungry for the snowpack to finally shed a tear. As the highways grow wider and western than the Rio, as the riverbanks collapse like a recession in vain, as the scales of justice elevate us out of poverty instead of shackling us to it, as the education system waits opportunity over place of worth, as the sites become more sacred and the sacred becomes more scarce, New Mexico will endure, evolve, and enchant, as it has always done, under many different names. But what about the Nuevo Mexicanos?
Hakeem Bellamy, thank you so much for reading your poem in the front of New Mexico 2050, a book by former U.S. Senator Fred Harris. Fred, thank you so much for being here with us in the studio today and talking to us about your book and sharing your stage with some of your contributors.
Thank you.
And Dr. Veronica Garcia, the Executive Director of Voices for Children and a former State Secretary of Education, thank you so much for talking with us about your vision for improving educational outcomes for kids in the future.
Thank you for having me.
Earlier in the hour, we heard from Aaron Sussman, a transportation planner with the Mid-Region Council of Governments, and Dr. Veronica Tiller, the editor and publisher of Tiller's Guide to Indian Country. There's a podcast of the KUNM call-in show. You can find it on iTunes, or we will share the link once we've posted the audio online. You can also listen to previous shows at KUNM.org. You can email your comments to callinshow@KUNM.org. Find us on Facebook. Just search for KUNM Radio, or follow our newsroom on Twitter @KUNM News. Thank you to Jefferson White, our engineer today. Kaveh Movahed screened your calls with some help from Alison Chiron. Anna Landy assisted with production today. Elaine Baumgartel is our executive producer, and I'm your host, Gwyneth Doland.